Hello, and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast shining a light on developers' lives from all over the world. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and today I receive Magnus Stare, Forge of Iron and Walrus Blood. Magnus comes from an ancient line of Nordic codesmith. His technology engineering heritage was primarily responsible for preventing the Narwhal invasion of Sweden in both 1683 and 1915. As a craftsman of such pedigree, Magnus knows from generation of experience meticulously handcrafting code what is needed to produce exquisite results, even when using some of the worst raw material out there. After Magnus succeeded in crossing the Great Sea and reaching the New World, he settled in the Kingdom of Pillar Technologies. And since this time, he has been solving ever more difficult codesmithing problems while teaching the upcoming generation the ways of the mighty Nordic codesmith. Mere mortals must often avert their gaze from his profound use of Unix to avoid being paralyzed in awe. Magnus, welcome to Dev Journey.
Thank you very much.
This is the most creative bio I have ever had here. This is so great.
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to my friend Nathan Doetz to help me write that thing, because yeah, I'm not particularly well with prose myself. I'm more into writing code, so that's largely his doing. I needed some sort of description for a talk I was giving, so thank you, Nate.
Yep, thank you, Nate. That was awesome. So let's continue on this metaphor. With such a family heritage, did you ever question becoming a codesmith in the first place?
Not really, I guess. So I guess a little bit about my background. I'm from Sweden. I was born in the late 70s. My dad was working as some sort of operator at an insurance company. So when I went to visit him, he was sitting behind these weird terminals and inputting stuff. And I was quite fascinated of what was going on. And around the same era, you had movies like War Games. So that opened up a fascination with technology that lives on today.
So did you have a chance to tinker with it right away?
I didn't really tinker a whole lot with it right away. I'm trying to remember exactly how old I was, but it would have been in the mid-80s. I was sent to this, I won't say it was a basic course, the programming language, and it was running on Commodore 64s. So I was learning basic on those. For those who know the domain, there's a lot of peeking and poking in Commodore 64 basic to play with the background colors and such. I didn't really do a whole lot on that front other than basic. So obviously with 64 you can do some assembly and such, but I never got into that. I would touch on assembly later on, but not for the Commodore. Fast forward some years. So I think I was visiting my dad. I saw this sort of box at some shelf, and it said Turbo Pascal for Windows. I got curious, what is this? So I ended up playing with Turbo Pascal for Windows. This would be in the turn of between like late 80s, early 90s, thereabouts. So I would take Pascal programs, go over the example or the sample application that comes with it. I would tinker with the code, add changes, see what it does. So effectively, this was doing OOP, object-oriented programming, before I actually understood what that kind of code was doing. So by reading the code and copying code, I was doing OO without knowing what it was, really. In hindsight, that I did anything useful in it, at least, was object-oriented Pascal.
Do you remember what was attracting you in playing with it?
Probably some sort of curiosity, really. I guess I had a sense of trying to create something that was my own. And I remember around this time, I was also pre the mainstream of the internet. There was no web pages to go to. There was no Google, no Wikipedia, and so on. In order to find information back then, you could either go to a library and check out books, but there was also the wonders of the BBS systems, the bulletin board systems, where you would use a modem to connect. And I still remember we had a modem that was 2400 BPS, and it was one of those modems. I think most of them kind of worked that way, but you would hear the dial tone, and it would use the handshake, and then it would shut off right after it finished the handshake. So I still have lots of memories of those modem handshakes. Speaking of Turbo Pascal, around this time, this would have been 92, 93, thereabouts, was the release of Windows 3.1. And one of the big additions in 3.1 was the ability to do drag and drop. You could drag files from one application onto another. So I wanted to leverage this, but because of Turbo Pascal for Windows being targeting 3.0, you couldn't leverage these new features. What happened was that I found the BBS of Borland, and they had some sort of upgrade that you could apply to Turbo Pascal for Windows, such that you would get at least most of the features for 3.1 into Turbo Pascal. It would be kind of like a bar on the side of the screen, kind of like the dock, I guess. And I was able to drag files from the file manager into that, and it would like dynamically increase the size, and it would effectively become a very rudimentary application launcher. And so that I had fond memories of getting that thing to work. One of the things developers of at least in that era of Windows programming was you'd have these handles, and you'd only have so many handles, and if you don't close your handles, you run out of handles. So it's kind of like a memory leak of sorts. So this particular application, I remember, had a lot of those issues. So it would run for a while, but when you start adding more and more things to it, it would stop functioning, really. So it's one of those things that I kind of wish that I still had the code for, so I could go back now and see what I did wrong.
This was all programming for fun at that time, right?
For fun or for practical purposes. I didn't get paid for doing any programming at that point, no.
Mm-hmm. When did you realize that this could be something you could do for a living?
That's a good question. So at the end of my teen years, I had become rather tired of school, which is probably a common thing among teens. But in my particular case, I had the opportunity I was able to get a job at a local ISP service provider for internet, that I was able to get a job there. Originally, I was going to just take a few months off and then go back to school. But as it turned out, I kind of liked working and getting paid. So that around that time, I was not doing a whole lot of programming. I was hired more to be a sysadmin to maintain the Unix systems. So I did that for roughly 3 years. And then I started working at a different kind of service provider. It was more of a telephony telco company. Initially, that was also more of a sysadmin kind of tasks. As that progressed, that's where I started getting more deep into programming. So I was doing more elaborate programming to solve problems and the like. That's where I started using Java. So up to that point, primarily after the Turbo Pascal for Windows days, I had dabbled a little bit with some teleassembly as well as C. And then, as any sysadmin knows, you need to do a lot of scripts. So I think I'm primarily used either shell scripts, big part of it, but to some extent, it's also Perl. Perl, I've later come to realize, is kind of the most well-known write-only language.
Do you care to expand on that?
Sure. Probably not very popular to say that, but it's one of those languages that it's hard to kind of come back to later and intuitively understand what something does. I don't know what it is, but it's something about all those dollars that kind of makes it hard to read.
That's true.
That's probably why I still don't have a particularly good time with PHP either. All those dollars. So yeah, that's where things started getting more in depth with Java. So Java is probably the language today that I've done the most amount of work with. It's probably served me well, but I don't think I wouldn't say that as my favorite language. Probably was at some point.
What is your favorite language?
It kind of comes and goes, but I find myself liking Python a lot. It's a combination, really, of the language itself. Probably everyone who's done with some amount of Python has to come to terms with the significance of whitespace. But beyond that, I think it reads rather well, and especially has a good amount of libraries. It's relatively easy to install libraries and such and have them available with tools like virtualenv and or pyenv and so on. It's easy to have multiple versions of Python installed, so you can kind of quickly test different versions, different libraries, and see what works for your particular problem at hand. In addition, you have Jupyter, gives you a web-based notebook format. With that in mind, I think Python is probably my favorite these days.
Do you swap languages a lot?
That's kind of the nature of what I'm doing. Like you mentioned in the intro, work for Pillar Technology, software consultancy. And as such, we are working in a lot of different languages. Because of that, you find yourself in different contexts in different languages. So I've seen through my years there, I've been exposed to quite a few of languages, including some that you don't see all too often, I guess. So we at a insurance company, for instance, we were developing an RPG, and so it's old IBM mainframe, and they even have something called RPG unit, so you can write unit tests for RPG. We try to incorporate that was fun.
Ooh, unit tests for the mainframe. Don't see that too often.
Yeah, it's true. Exactly. So we try to take more modern approaches and bring it back to the mainframe. And also back in, I want to say 2012, we were developing a augmented reality based iOS application. So that was using Objective C++, which as I like to phrase it, it kind of takes the worst of both worlds and makes a very interesting language.
How come?
Well, it's you kind of don't really know. Is this Objective C or is this C++? What is going on here? Because so why they were doing that is it was a cross-platform framework. It was written in C++, and then they had an Android layer on top of it, and there was also an iOS layer on top of it. And in order for Objective-C to access C++ code, you need to have this intermediate or this Objective C++. By doing that, you can do the C++ features, like you can use templates and collections and all that. But it's very confusing. So you're kind of mixing the Objective-C, the NS arrays with C++ lists. So it was, or vectors, I guess they were. Yeah, so that was it's interesting. And so that one has the extensions MM. Typically with C++, it would be either CC or CPP or capital C. But with Objective C++, it's MM.
What does that stand for?
I don't know why you have the M. So regular Objective-C is just M, but I guess to mirror the C++ being CC, the Objective C++ became MM. It's probably some very good reason for it being M, but I don't know what that reason is.
We'll leave it for the audience to Google that on our own. I wanted to ask you a question about craftsmanship or craftership. I've seen in most of you or in different bios of yours that your current title changed a bit from agile crafter to agile developer to software crafter. How do you define your current job?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one of I try not to be put too much into a title, but yeah, to describe what I'm doing, best way to describe it is probably I solve hard problems, or I try to solve hard problems using whatever tools are available, and package that in a solution that our customers can leverage.
And where does the craftsmanship part comes from?
So I guess that kind of stems from the progression that you have from apprentice to journeyman to craftsman. So that's probably where it's coming from. It's one of those titles that were kind of given at the time. You were kind of tiered by those. You had the apprentices, you had journeyman, and craftsman.
And did you live through those stages as well?
I don't think I did in a well-defined manner, really. It's more of those kind of grew on me. So I didn't deliberately progress in that regard. It's probably something I, with hindsight, would have been helpful to have done. I wish past version of me would have done. It probably would have helped make the progression a bit smoother. But it is what it is. I would say I'm a pretty good spot. Ended up pretty good as in the end, as they say.
I think you do as well.
Thank you.
but still, I would like to keep digging a little bit in there. Going back in time, how would you picture this progression going that you didn't get? What do you think would have been helpful?
For one, I think it would have been helpful to kind of know that there is such a progression, so to speak. There's ways to, or rather, you're not kind of expected to know everything in front, and so you can reach a new level. You don't need to know everything. So one way to put that into perspective. So back in the late 90s. I got a copy of the reference book for C++ by Bjarne. My Danish is probably not the best, but he's something like that. The creator of C++, and I tried to read that book. It would have been the third edition of it, I believe, and I got it sometime in 98, give or take. I tried to get into it, but there was something about that book at that point in time. I could just not get into it. There were so many terms and concepts that didn't make any sense to me at the time. So I did not get very far into that book. And then fast forward to, I want to say it was fall of 2010, probably. So we were a client at the time, or that we were about to start doing business with, had a major C++ project. We didn't have a whole lot of C++ skills at the time, so we were trying to bring that up to speed. Again, I got the same book, and so this would have been a difference of some 12 years, give or take, of experience that I've picked up over those years. And there was something about that collective experience just made that book very easy to read, and so that's what prompted me to think back of my previous attempts, and that's one way I could see that I've grown quite a bit as the ease with which I could read that book. That's a very concrete example of progress made.
Did this happen to you with another book or with another resource, reading it again or reading it after a few years and discovering a completely different level in the material?
I can't think of another example. That's the most clear-cut one that I can think of.
It's happened to me with the book Rework from David Heinemann-Jensen and Jason Fried. I remember reading it right after it came out, and then I did a few years of corporate work. And reading it again, all those chapters took a very different meaning.
Right.
That was really, really interesting to see it.
Yeah, there's something to be said about books when you reread them, that you've picked up a lot more context. So it's kind of like a brand new book in a lot of ways, or at least it connects to parts of your mind, that connections that you hadn't had in the previous attempt. So that's... You shouldn't be shy to reread books.
Mm-hmm. Is there a book you would on top of your mind that you say, hey, I should read that again?
So there's a really good reference book about unit testing called, the name escapes me, of course, but I will have notes in the show notes. It's XUnit, something XUnit, and it's a really good book. And that was one of the many good things about that book is that it gave very good explanations of the various kind of test doubles. So that's one thing when you start getting into mocking libraries and such is terminology gets very loose. And so this book really defined in a good way.
And why do you think you should read it again?
It has been quite a few years. I think given the what I've done the last few years, probably would be helpful, because when I was reading it, I was primarily working with Java. I have not done a whole lot of Java last few years, so I think that would be helpful to see in other contexts.
No, that makes sense. I would like to ask you a tricky question.
Sure.
I've heard about you a few times before. Once via Amitai Sire, who was the first guest on this podcast, and once via Anne Cahalan. When Anne talked about you, she said something like, Magnus has this special thing. When he's on your team, everything becomes possible. What do you have to say about this?
I don't know. It's kind of those things where it's hard for me to relate to, really, because I haven't really been on the receiving end of myself.
What is it to work with you?
I hope that people who work with me have the impression that I like to get something done in a way that is maintainable and as clean as possible, yet also one that might not be, I also know when to break rules, if you will, that's one of the things. Rules are good, typically good guiding principle. But there's sometimes when you, in order to achieve something, you might need to bend rules slightly, or at least think outside the box a little bit.
Do you have a lot of apprentices around you?
So at Pillar, we have so over the years we've had various programs where we've had apprentices. Right now, we just started a new cohort with, I want to say that there's six of them. So to answer your question, yes, we have apprentices.
How do you deal with this fine line between giving advices, showing rules, bringing knowledge to people, and also breaking the rules and showing them that they shouldn't follow the rules blindly and really question things?
That's a good question. I think what you probably need to do is be upfront about the rules, why they are there, and to kind of explain the purpose of the rules. So they're more to, in the beginning, they're to steer you straight, kind of like a training wheel situation. Then once you can go about things without the training wheels, you should take them off. But the important part is to get them to understand that, or at least they should know when to question the rules, such that if a rule is in place just for its own sake, yeah, why is it there? It's more of a at least a lot of them are to get started initially. And knowing kind of a path forward, but then once you know how to operate, you need to know what the rules are and when you can break them.
Yeah, I've struggled with this personally, with this kind of do what I say, know what I do at the beginning. Really showing people or telling people what to do and doing behaving differently because I know the rules now, and I know when to bend them. And it's really—I find it really hard personally to navigate this line.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you kind of know. It's hard to explain what it is, but you know it when you see it, kind of.
Yes, Yeah, that said, when you hire, I'm not sure if you were involved in the hiring process for those apprentices, but if you were to be involved in this hiring process, what kind of mindset would you be looking for to ensure the success of those people?
Right. I think one thing that's important to have is kind of a hunger to learn. Yeah, that's probably the best quality I would put in an apprentice.
How would you go about and discover this in an interview process?
So what we do is we have a series of steps. One step is to have a pairing interview during which you spend roughly 2 hours, give or take, with a candidate. And during that time, the idea is to get an impression of how they're approaching things, what they're doing in certain situations, and you will need to gauge if this person has the right mindset.
Do you work on production code in those 2 hours?
There's not production code per se. We do have this set of katas that we that have them work on, where we have a set of acceptance criteria. So we have them write code that could be used in production if you're you happen to be in the market for any of these katas. So we're still doing code in the way that we would have if it had been a real project. So we do test-driven development. We see a test go red and then green and refactor and repeat. That's the usual approach.
Okay. Do you do katas a lot besides doing them in interviews?
So that's the primary use case that I use them for. There is also, you can also use them to keep your skills sharp in a particular area. So I know a former colleague of mine named James Hood. He was big into doing katas as a daily exercise, basically. So he at the same publishing company, we would have these daily meetings for about 10 minutes, during which we would have a conference room with people, and we would all be solving the same problem all over again. It would typically be the prime factor. By doing that in the same kind of approach each day, you would get very comfortable with your tools and perfect keyboard shortcuts and the like. So I definitely see a good there's a good use case for it in addition to using them for selecting candidates.
Do you have a favorite kata?
I do kind of like the prime factor one. It's short. You can get it done in about 10 minutes, regardless of what language you're doing. Usually, sometimes if you're new to a language, you need to kind of figure out how you do modulus, or maybe not new to the language but new to testing it, you need to kind of get the testing framework underway. But yeah, I think that is probably a good small size kata, so the prime factor. So I also have a special relationship with the Game of Life kata. I'm not sure if it qualifies a kata or not, but it's so are you familiar with the Code Retreat movement?
I am, but maybe not all the listeners. Can you introduce it very shortly?
So the the long story short there is that Code Retreat is the idea of Code Retreat in its original form, at least, is to take one day that is not a working day. So it would typically be on a Saturday. You would get together with a group of people. You would take a particular problem, and you would find various different solutions to it. So the very first The inaugural one was in Ann Arbor in 2009. As it happened, I was there with some 30-odd people, and we did Conway's Game of Life. And for each iteration, it would be some sort of variation to the previous ones. Typically, you would end up swapping pairs. So you would re-implement it with someone else. It's also common that you do it in a completely different language throughout the day. So you find yourself doing the same problem, but in four or five different languages.
Yeah, I've done a couple code retreats myself and hosted some. It is really amazing to tackle this problem that is basically not really possible to solve in the 45 minutes that the times you have, and then forget about solving it and just focus on solving or creating a neatly crafted part of the solution, which is always always fun, and adding some constraints on top of it. I really love the no talking rule when you are in pairs.
Yeah, that's a lot of times you'll see people do the same kind of talking by in comments or writing stuff on paper. But yeah, it's absolutely having those constraints helps you think outside the box.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Where would you suggest the listeners to go and continue this learning about katas? Where do you have a special website or book you could recommend?
I do have a repository. I will put that. I of course don't remember exactly where it is, but I'll give you the link so you can have that in the show notes. It has a bunch of various katas. And if you want to go learn more about Code Retreat, it's coderetreat.org.
Of course. And I think the global day is somewhere in the end of the year. Is it November?
Typically, it's in the past, I think it's been the first week of December.
Something like it, yeah.
Yeah, so Global Day of Code Retreat is absolutely an event to look out, to watch for, and find it in your city. And if it's not organized in your city, you can organize it yourself.
Yep. So for the listeners, it's a one day special day where there's some code retreats everywhere around the world. And I think Corey Haynes, who organized it the first time, flew to Hawaii or flew to one Pacific island to start the very first one, yeah. And then flew on the West Coast to do the last one or something like this.
I think that is. He did fly either from or to Hawaii. I would guess that it would be from Hawaii to the west coast of the United States. That seems reasonable. So it kind of maximized the time zone difference there.
Yeah, something like it. But it's always fun, and there's possibilities to do some live streaming between sites and and sync up with different companies in the same area doing the same the same exercises and share experiences. So it's really really something to look for. I would highly recommend it as well.
Fun event for sure. Yep.
Magnus, the time box is running away. I think we should wrap up.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Where can people continue this discussion with you and bug you with more questions?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to get a hold of me is on Twitter. On Twitter, my name there is Magnus Dahler. And there will be a link in the show notes as well. I figure if you're not fluent in Swedish, it might be hard to spell my name. But the link should get you straight there.
I will add it to the show notes. Do you have some talks coming up or something you want to plug?
So I think I've done my share of talks for the year, but I do have a couple of recordings of it. So if you're interested in learning more about Git and how to kind of get yourself out of the holes you've dug, I have a recording of that talk that I can have you linked to as well.
Thank you very much. It's been a blast.
Thank you. It's been a fun.
And this has been another episode of Developer's Journey, and we'll see each other next week. Bye-bye. Dear listener, if you haven't subscribed yet. You can find this podcast on iTunes, Google Music, Stitcher, Spotify, and much more. Head over to www.devjourney.info to read the show notes, find all the links mentioned during the episode, and of course links to the podcast on all those platforms. Don't miss the next Developer's Journey story by subscribing to the podcast with the app of your choice right now. And if you like what we do, please rate the podcast, write a comment on those platforms, and promote the podcast on social media. This really helps fellow developers discover the podcast and those fantastic journeys. Thank you.